Today on the show, we are exploring the wonderful world of paleobotany with the Permian age plant Glossopteris. This episode, we talk about gymnosperms, high latitude forests, and piecing together the theory of plate tectonics. Owls and Paleo presents Glossopteris. Let's go back. This is Pals in Paleo, the show where we dig into the form, function, and family history of your favorite fossils. I'm your host, paleontologist, science communicator, and on today's episode, budding paleobotanist Adele Pentland. You can stay up to date with me and my terrible dad jokes on Instagram by following at Pals in Paleo. Pals and Paleo acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This episode was recorded on Koa Country in Winton, central western Queensland, and fossils of Glossopteris are known from sites across Australia and overseas. Okay, confession time. I kind of knew, even before I started the podcast, that I'd sort of gravitate towards doing episodes on topics familiar to me. So lots of episodes on vertebrates and fossils from the Cretaceous. And since we've done a couple vertebrates back to back, I figured it was about damn time we have a break from animals with backbones and head to uncharted territory and dive into the no-bone zone. That's a term I've appropriated from the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California, an incredible organization with a legendary online presence that also works with researchers on cutting-edge science. So I want to plant a seed, literally, and focus on Glossopteris, a fossil plant from the Permian, so the time period just before the first dinosaurs appeared at the start of the Triassic. Today's episode was also partly inspired by another podcast called Just the Zoo of Us with Christian and Ellen Weatherford. Their show is a complete and utter delight. It's on extant species of animal, so stuff that's still alive today, and they don't just focus on charismatic megafauna, but on their show, they really try to strike a balance and talk about invertebrates and fish, animals that don't have the same PR behind them the way that, you know, tigers and pandas do. So yeah, that's kind of why I wanted to cover a fossil plant from a time period that predates the dinosaurs. I wanted to break free from this holding pattern of my own making, and I figured it was also time to cover something that isn't uniquely Australian, but found at other fossil localities elsewhere in the world. I also wouldn't be a paleontologist, and I wouldn't be speaking to you today, if I hadn't met a paleobotanist and palynologist by the name of Dr. Chris Mays. By the way, a palynologist is someone who studies fossil spore and pollen grains. Chris, or Maisie, as we always called him, taught me for second year sedimentology, so the soft rock course at Monash University, and he also taught the paleontology unit, which, this is going to sound super cliche, but it literally changed my life. The funny thing is, I didn't get the best marks in a paleontology course. I don't even think I came second overall. I think I was third, but I did get the best marks in our paleobotany prac course. Essentially, it was a mini assignment, but the student who got the highest marks received a piece of petrified wood Chris had collected during field work in the Chatham Islands. The Chatham Islands are a tiny set of islands off the coast of New Zealand, about 800 kilometers to the east of the South Island, which is almost 500 miles. So yeah, a very remote location. Anyway, I still have this piece of petrified wood. It sits on my desk along with my other fossil themed knickknacks, including a Lego model of Ferro Draco. But after that, I really wanted to do paleontology and wanted to get into honors, work on a project with Chris as my supervisor, and the rest is history. Even though I was inspired at uni to study paleontology because of a paleobotanist, I have zero experience when it comes to fossil plants. Of course, I can pick when I found a fossil plant in the field and know what's a good specimen for a museum collection, but that's about it. So if you're a botanist and work on fossil plants, just turn the podcast off now. No, I'm kidding. That was a joke. Please, though, do go easy on me because I don't have any formal training in this, but I've tried my best. Before we get into the weeds and discuss Glossopteris, first up is our random fossil fact. Some paleontology-themed podcasts bring you news. I bring you facts that have aged like fine wine. When the fossils have waited millions and millions of years to be discovered, what's another couple years on top of that? I also appropriated that saying. It's something Dr. Tom Rich, curator of vertebrate paleontology at Museums Victoria, says to me sometimes. Anyway, today's random fossil fact is what I'm calling the first fossil dance floor from the journal Scientific Reports, published by Martin G. Lockley and colleagues in early 2016. So a pretty prestigious journal. I believe Scientific Reports is under Nature Publishing, and Lockley is basically, he's a badass. He's basically the expert when it comes to fossil tracks. Ichnology, the study of trace fossils, isn't just about footprints either. You can find all sorts of impressions, including resting impressions, or as I like to think of them, butt prints, feeding traces made from animals lunging into soft sediment or bird beaks probing into the ground, and burrows. Trace fossils also include fossil feces or coprolites, regurgitalites, which is fossil vomit, and eggs. I'm probably missing something, but yeah, just think of anything that indicates the presence of an organism that's a trace fossil. This is opposed to a body fossil, which is direct evidence because it's literally the body or part of it. Ichnofossils can reveal a lot about animal behavior. For example, fossil footprints can be used to determine the speed and size of an animal. It's basically like forensic science, but prehistoric. Think CSI Gondwana. This paper is about more than just footprints, but something much more rare, dinosaurs dancing. The title of the paper sums it up better than I ever could. It's Theropod Courtship, Large-Scale Physical Evidence of Display Arenas and Avian-like Scrape Ceremony Behavior by Cretaceous Dinosaurs. These authors discovered scoop mark and hummocks at four different sites across Colorado, specifically from the Dakota Sandstone, which is late Albian to Cenomanian in age, which makes it about 100 million years old, give or take a few million years. The tracks are attributed to theropod dinosaurs since they're the only animals walking around on two legs that can make something this size. The scrape marks are all symmetrical but vary in shape. Some are oval and others paired claw marks, and they differ in size as well. They're anywhere between 3/4 to 2 meters long and 1/2 to 1.25 meters wide. So that'd make the scrape marks between 2.5 feet to 6.5 feet long and 1.6 feet to 4.1 feet wide. The depth also varies. Some are pretty shallow at only 5 centimeters or 2 inches deep, but others are up to 25 centimeters or a foot in depth. The scoops have clear claw marks at their deepest points, which could only be made by an animal dragging its claws along the ground. As the name of the paper suggests, the main theory is that these were made by theropod dinosaurs doing a boot scootin' boogie to attract members of the opposite sex, like we see today in some species of modern-day ground-nesting birds. Which is super impressive, because Untouched by the Veronicas didn't come out until 2007. Only joking. Although, when that song comes on, I am a woman possessed. I've been known to bail out of a conversation and run, literally run, to the other side of the room to the dance floor when I hear it. That and Footloose. Can't help myself. Lockley and colleagues came up with a few alternative explanations suggesting these might be nests, but there's no evidence of eggshells, and when you compare this site to fossil dinosaur nest sites, these vary too much in terms of their size and depth, and the scrape marks are just a bit more random. By contrast, known dinosaur nest sites and fossil colonies are very evenly spaced and consistently shaped, and of course they have eggshells. Alternatively, they might be the result of hungry or parched dinosaurs digging for food or water, or territorial scrape marks made when an animal is attempting to ward off would-be adversaries. Again, it's not outside the realm of possibility, but based on the behavior of modern-day birds and their courtship rituals, we observe these same scrape marks, albeit on a smaller scale, in specific areas or display arenas. In terms of figuring out which theropod made these marks, that's another kettle of fish. It's almost impossible to figure out which animal made which track. We don't know which species made these, but yeah, it was a large theropod, so that's the same group T-Rex belongs to. If you want to find out more and see photos of the scrape marks, I'll put a link to the article in the show notes, as well as another article summarizing the paper from the conversation. From the dance floor to the forest floor, let's go further back in time now and head into the Permian to talk about Glossopteris. All right, let's get into the form, function, and family grouping of Glossopteris. This was a prolific fossil plant that thrived during the Permian period, with its earliest appearance in the fossil record dating back to about 299 million years ago. It was found throughout the southern hemisphere during this period, but went extinct during the end Permian mass extinction event about 252 million years ago. The end Permian mass extinction event has also been given the fun nickname, the Great Dying, because it's the most intense mass extinction event to date. Life was nearly completely wiped out. It's estimated that between 90 to 95% of species went extinct at the end of the Permian. So if you ever get the chance to go back in time, highly recommend you skip that part of Earth history. If you want to hear me talk more about this pivotal moment, please let me know. I'm at Pals in Paleo on Instagram. If you request this as an episode topic, it'll be at the top of the list because there's a lot of research on it, and it's not fair that the end Cretaceous mass extinction event gets so much attention when this is the biggie. Anyway, let's talk about what the hell Glossopteris is, because I think up until this point of the podcast, I've only referred to it as a plant. Broadly speaking, Glossopteris was a tall, woody tree, so imagine something a bit like a conifer, but with broad leaves instead of the thin, needle-like leaves pine trees are known for. Just to be clear, we're not completely sure what the full thing looked like, because that fossil is essentially a unicorn, in that it is rare and virtually non-existent. As paleontologist and paleobotanist Dr. Anne-Marie Tosolini, a senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne, explains, piecing together different plant fossils can be quite difficult.
With plants, it's a bit more of a puzzle to put the pieces of the plant back together, so it's quite different to finding fossil animals. Often you'll find the leaves quite separate from the roots or the tree trunks or the fruiting bodies. So roots, for example, are given a completely different name to the leaves, and they're known as vertebraria. They actually look a lot like a segmented vertebrae. So that's why it's always been a challenge to work out what kinds of roots and branches and tree trunks matched with the leaves.
Sometimes you can find part of a tree stump in situ, which is Latin for in life position, but the chances of a whole tree being found in situ with leaves still attached after millions of years is pretty low. Still, the best fossils are the ones we have. We can learn a lot just by piecing everything together, and the fossil record is also full of surprises. I was delighted to find out there's been fossils of Glossopteris found with their leaves still attached to their stems. The paper was published by Pig and Taylor in the American Journal of Botany in 1993. The fossil was discovered in a very remote location, specifically the Central Transantarctic Mountains in Antarctica. Kind of makes sense that you'd find such an exceptional fossil in pristine and untouched wilderness, although you'd be surprised what turns up even nowadays with building works and stuff like that. I'll put a link to that paper in the show notes, but unfortunately, that one isn't in open access. If you have a subscription to that journal, though, or you're affiliated with a university, you might be able to still get access to it. I try not to do this too often, but yeah, this paper's pretty special, so I just had to mention it. Unlike most of the other fossils we've talked about on the podcast, Glossopteris is known from multiple specimens, and it comes in a few different shapes and sizes. If you just search for it in Google, you'll probably see photos of fossil leaf mats, which looks how it sounds. They're basically slabs of rock with leaves fossilized on the surface. Now, you might be wondering, how do paleontologists, and in this case, paleobotanists, tell the difference between different species? It's based on a combination of shape, size, and the structure of the veins, or the lines that branch off from the center, or the midrib, as it's known. Glossopteris leaves are longer than they are wide and teardrop-shaped. The leaves vary a bit in size, ranging from between 2 to 30 centimeters, so less than an inch to about a foot long.
Leaves of Glossopteris are very beautiful and they look quite modern. So when students look at the Glossopteris fossil leaves, they often ask, are these modern flowering trees, or some ask, are they eucalypts? So it's remarkable their anastomosing veins are really very advanced for their time. They were probably very good at photosynthesizing, but they were over 100 million years before any flowers appeared.
As far as leaves go, they can get to a pretty decent size. If you've seen fossils on display at a museum or university, especially those in the Southern Hemisphere, chances are you might have seen some of these IRL. Pretty sure we used to have some in the hallway of the geology building at my old uni. If you want to get technical, the genus Glossopteris only applies to the leaves. So even though there are probably fossil cones from this same species, in the literature, they're referred to the broader family of Glossopteridaceae. Again, it might be because things have already been named and then later it was found that they actually belong to the same species, but I'm just spitballing here. I don't know. I don't make the rules. Those Glossopteridaceae cones I mentioned before are analogous to pine cones on conifer trees and the cones of cycads. So imagine something pretty tough, maybe a bit on the woody or chewy side, and not something you would want to eat. The other form Glossopteris fossils come in, for better or worse, is coal. Intense pressure and temperature conditions has transformed the forests of the Permian into a fuel source exploited across the southern continents.
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real-life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits, but then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
Another really interesting thing about Glossopteris is that it's key in our understanding of plant evolution. It was a significant element in swamp flora that formed important Permian coal measures right across the Southern Hemisphere. And these have been used as critical energy resources for over 100 years. But it helps us understand the evolution of what's known as gymnosperms before flowers had even evolved.
Most of the Permian-aged coal deposits across what used to be Gondwana are made up of gymnosperms like Glossopteris, and there were tons of them. If you think of peat, which is essentially decaying plant matter, spelt P-E-A-T, you would need 10 meters of peat to make a 1 meter layer of coal. And when you think about how much coal there is, there would have been millions and millions of Glossopteris trees throughout Earth history. Out of all the fossils we've talked about on the show so far, this one probably has affected the most lives based on its economic impact alone. The bulk of these coal deposits were made from what used to be trees, with Glossopteris growing to estimated heights of 30 meters, which is almost 100 feet tall. As far as I can tell, there isn't anything else I need to mention regarding the physical form of this fossil, so let's now talk about how this influenced how this organism functioned. Pretty self-explanatory, but like modern plants today, Glossopteris used its leaves for photosynthesis, converting water and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into sugars and oxygen. It's also assumed that Glossopteris was deciduous, based on the sheer volume of fossil leaves that are found together. If you look closely, there's really nothing wrong with these leaves for the most part. They're not sickly looking or anything like that, so why get rid of them? Well, like deciduous trees today, this is typically triggered by a change in the seasons and more common in trees at mid to high latitudes, so getting further away from the equator. The reason for that is the winter months are hard, so hard that holding onto their leaves during this period is more of a liability than anything else. So it's just easier to get rid of all of them and start again when the growing conditions become more favorable in the spring or summer. This interp is backed up by the patterns we see in the growth rings of Glossopteris trees. Not only can you count the rings to figure out how old a tree is, but depending on the thickness of each ring, you can work out what else is going on. What I mean by that is the thicker the ring, the better that growing season was. Glossopteris grew the best during the spring and summer season, but growth was just about ground to a halt in autumn and winter. Glossopteris trees were able to grow to massive heights because they're a type of vascular plant, but I'll get to that in a minute when we talk about the evolutionary history of this species. But basically, the fact that they had secondary lignin, or bark, on the outside, which not only protected the tree from insects and stuff like that, that bark was also the scaffolding which allowed them to grow and get ridiculously tall, again maxing out at 30 meters or almost 100 feet. Growing tall is an important adaptation that allows plants to compete with others in their environment for sunlight. And once they get to a certain size, they're also less likely to be eaten by herbivores. Bark is the botanical equivalent of growing a tough skin or armor, and again, offers protection from predation from insects and fungal pathogens and stuff like that. The Glossopteris forests, say that five times fast, grew at mid to high latitudes, so closer to the geographic poles and not at the equator. Presumably, the trees resembled a conifer in shape. So imagine a Christmas tree, which is tapered at the top. It grows to that specific shape to get as much of that low angle light as possible. If you've visited anywhere near the Arctic or live in Northern Europe, you'll know what I'm talking about with the low angle light thing. The sun just sits a bit lower in the sky compared to the equator, and that also changes with the seasons. We've talked about form, we've talked about function. Now let's dive into the family grouping of Glossopteris. Broadly speaking, Glossopteris is a vascular plant, meaning that it transports sugars and other nutrients around its body using a series of tubes. Chances are, if you see a plant today and it doesn't look like it's 95% water and can grow over 30 centimeters or a foot long, it's probably a vascular plant. I can't believe my last words to Maud were no foot longs. Anyway, off the top of my head, the things that aren't vascular plants are algae, mosses, hornworts, and liverworts. Glossopteris is a type of gymnosperm, which in Latin literally means naked seed. In fact, during the Permian period, angiosperms, or the flowering plants, which are the most common land plants on Earth today, they hadn't even evolved yet. As Anne-Marie Tossellini explains, Glossopteris also differs from modern conifers, even though, yes, they are both types of gymnosperms.
Glossopteris are key to understanding plant evolution, and during the Permian period, known as the Paleozoic era, there were only gymnosperms around. There were no flowers. And so they were quite different to the conifers we see today, and they were probably closer to other seed plants known as seed ferns, like cycads is probably the only remaining plant surviving today from that whole lineage. Ginkgo is another example, actually.
Definitely also want to cover ginkgo in a future paleoplant episode, even though, yes, there is still one species alive today. Unlike most other plants today, gymnosperms don't have flowers and they don't have fruit. Like I said, you could probably eat a Glossopteris cone, but why would you? It probably wouldn't taste very good and wouldn't be super nutritious. Remember, it's important not to get caught up in doing something to the point where you forget to ask yourself, is this a good idea? Glossopteris was a perennial plant, meaning that they lived for more than a year, which makes sense, right? Gotta live for more than a year to get to those big sizes. I couldn't find an exact number of different species, but there's over 70 species within the Glossopteris genus. Just to zoom out, Glossopteris belongs to the family Glossopteridaceae, which was described way back in 1828. In terms of human history and our understanding of paleontology, we've had a long time to get familiar with Glossopteris, and in fact, this fossil was fundamental to our understanding of geological processes. I teased at the very start of the episode that the theory of plate tectonics was proven to be true with the help from Glossopteris. As paleontologists started to unearth more and more fossils, it became apparent that there were specific patterns and certain similarities between some regions in that they had the exact same types of fossils, despite the fact that they are now separated by oceans. For a while there, it was a bit of a mystery as to how and why Glossopteris was found in Australia, New Zealand, South America, Africa, and India. These continents, of course, were once connected together and formed the southern supercontinent Gondwana, which we also mentioned in the episode on Anomalocaris.
Glossopteris was one of the key fossils that was discovered on South America and Africa, showing that they used to be joined together, as well as Australia and India, even though India is no longer in the Southern Hemisphere. So the remaining piece of that jigsaw puzzle was to see if Glossopteris was preserved as a fossil on Antarctica, the last frontier. Some beautifully preserved fossils have been found from Antarctica, preserved in 3D in silica, and this has helped to build a whole picture of Glossopteris trees.
It just goes to show that fossils can also help build our understanding of Earth through time, and paleontological discoveries were key in our understanding of plate tectonics. This theory was originally introduced as the theory of continental drift and championed by meteorologist Alfred Wegener in 1912. When he first presented this idea, it didn't have a lot of traction and basically wasn't accepted during his lifetime. Part of this is because Wegener was missing a mechanism driving continental drift. He had correctly identified what was happening, but was still struggling to explain how it was happening. The scientific community at the time were also reluctant to accept his theory because Wegener was an outsider. He wasn't a geologist, he was a meteorologist. Just to put this in context, this was at a time when science was a gentleman's pursuit. So I'll put it this way. Back in those days, I wouldn't have had a thriving career as a paleontologist because, for one thing, I'm a woman. And secondly, I'm half Asian. It was very elitist back then, and we obviously still have a long way to go. But yeah, scientists can be snobs sometimes. Wegener was an outsider, but his unique perspective was his biggest strength and asset, ultimately helping him to see the world as it is. There's a lesson to be learned here. The more we embrace different backgrounds and new ways of thinking, the better we can tackle complex problems. Wegener's theory was widely accepted, or as I like to think of it, became geological canon in the 1960s, with the discovery of magnetic anomalies on the ocean floor, which they found accidentally. During that time, during the Cold War, they were trying to focus on finding submarines, but instead they accidentally learned about the geological secrets of the ocean floor. Through this inadvertent detective work, they found the missing mechanism to Wegener's theory, subduction and spreading zones on the sea floor. The SparkNotes summary is that ocean crust gets heavy at a certain age and sinks, partly pushed by the formation of new ocean crust in other spots. I'll leave it at that. This is a paleontology podcast after all. For more on subduction zones, see our sister podcast, Gals in Geology. That's not an actual podcast, but bloody hell, I wish it was. If someone wants to start a Gals in Geology podcast, go for it. Getting back to our plant boy, fossils of Glossopteris, as well as the freshwater reptile, Mesosaurus, and the bulky Dicynodont, Lystrosaurus, which in the words of Steve Brassati, the last ones built like our quarterback linesmen, the distribution of those three fossils is really difficult to explain based on their current distribution. But when you push the continents they're found on together and in the right order, it makes perfect sense. There's a very good reason why the eastern coast of South America looks like the western coast of Africa. They were once connected but split apart during the breakup of Gondwana. So if anyone tries to tell you paleontology is basically stamp collecting, set them straight. It's so much more than that. Understanding ancient life can tell us a lot about how Earth has changed over millions of years and gives us insight into how it'll continue to change in the future. We've talked about the form, function, and family grouping of Glossopteris and taken a quick unexpected detour to discuss large-scale geologic processes through the theory of plate tectonics, and this is normally the part of the episode where I mention where you can find out more about the fossil we covered in today's episode, list the documentaries it's featured in, etc., etc. As you can probably work out, I don't have a name for this section of the show. I was thinking of calling it fandom, but that doesn't sound right either. I don't know if I'm using that word right. But yeah, if you have any ideas, let me know at Pals and Paleo on Instagram, because I don't know what to do. Anyway, fossil plants and plants in general don't quite get the same airplay and attention that vertebrates get. That said, I'm just about certain that if there's a doco that features ancient life from the Permian, there's bound to be Glossopteris in the background or somewhere. Maybe it's getting eaten by a herbivore. So if you know of an example, please share your wisdom with me. You can tag me at Pals and Paleo and I'll try to catch us up in a future episode. Otherwise, you can tag me in any paleontology or science memes. Before we wrap up with thank yous and some final recommendations, I wanted to make a couple of announcements. First off, I'm absolutely floored. I'm blown away by the response the podcast has gotten. And I wanted to say thank you to everyone who's listened, and a special thank you to everyone who's left a rating or a review and shared the podcast through social media. You're the best. I really didn't know what to expect when I started this. I mean, I thought my friends who knew I was working on this were going to tune in, but I thought that would be it, you know, 20 or so people. But yeah, I'm super grateful for everyone who's been listening so far. And if you sent me a really sweet message, I've saved it on my phone in a folder called Knockdown 7 times Backup 8. And as you can probably tell, when I'm having a really tough time, I go back through and I read those messages. In fact, you know what? Why not? I'm going to read one right now. This review is, or it's not even a review, it's a message from Alex. Alex says, "My work wife and I just listened to your podcast in the lab. Love it from a couple nature lovers to another. Can't wait for the next ep." And then they also said some other bits and pieces. But yeah, I'm just so thrilled at the idea of Pals in Paleo getting played in a lab setting. I know that when I was doing my honors research, I had a lot of like boring tasks to do. So I was listening to music a whole lot and podcasts as well. But yeah, hopefully your other workmates don't mind hearing me drone on about weird dead things. Okay, so the other announcement that I had is on Coolosuchus, which we covered in episode 2. So if you missed that one, Coolosuchus clelandi is a massive extinct amphibian and the state fossil emblem for Victoria, which is a state in Australia. Now, the science surrounding that fossil is still solid. I didn't stuff up there, but I did mark up some of the extra facts at the end of the episode. So I wanted to take a second to acknowledge that. I'm far from perfect. And I just want to highlight that science is self-correcting. What I mean by that is that as new information comes to light, it's okay for our view and our understanding of things to change and evolve and grow. At its core, this is how scientific research works. And I'm always going to do my best to try and bring you information that's up to date and accurate. This sounds super dramatic now, but it's really not anything major, I promise. Most of what I said is true, but at the end of the episode on Coolosuchus, I was talking about pop culture stuff, mentioned yaois, and was saying how I struggled to find stuff at the Melbourne Museum gift shop. By the way, yaois are kind of like Kinder Surprise in that there's a chocolate treat and a toy on the inside. But okay, first things first, there is no Coolosuchus yaoi. There is a Temnospondyl yaoi, but it's based on Siderops from the Jurassic of Queensland. So a different state and a completely different time period. Millions of years between them. Now, I'll probably end up doing an episode on Siderops at some point, but yes, I just want to acknowledge, I know they're different species. As for the Melbourne Museum gift shop, as it turns out, they do have some cool stuff featuring Coolosuchus. Shout out to Jack O'Connor and Jessica Campbell for letting me know what I was missing out on. To be honest, when I was last at Melbourne Museum in January, I was basically running around like a headless chook. If I saw this merch, it wasn't really on my radar because I was completely distracted. Professor Clelie Grice, who I mentioned in the Coolosuchus episode, was there on a research visit, and I really wanted to make a good impression since I hadn't yet joined her lab. Anyway, for anyone who's interested, there's a Coolosuchus enamel pin and even a birthday card in the Melbourne Museum gift shop. Jessica also mentioned that the new Gondwana Garden at Melbourne Museum has replica jaws of Coolosuchus that visitors can actually touch. They're pretty hard to miss since they're bright blue. Like I said in Ep 2, the real Coolosuchus holotype jaws are also on display. And speaking of pals and paleo alumni, there's also an Anomalocaurus model and fossilized mouthparts on display too. They're just around the corner from Coolosuchus. Again, thanks heaps, Jess, for letting me know all that useful information. And Jack as well, who had notes on the anatomy of Coolosuchus as well as merch. Honestly, I'll probably get Jack on the podcast at some point to talk about the work they did during their honours on Zygomaturus, which is a giant marsupial and close cousin of Diprotodon, which I seem to mention every second episode. And we'll probably expand on the form and function of Coolosuchus because Jack has made an amazing 3D sculpt of Coolosuchus too, and honestly, they know more about this ancient amphibian than I do. By the way, you can check out that 3D model on their Instagram, which is jackocdesign, all one word, and I'll pop that up in the show notes. But in terms of tangible, real-world Coolosuchus merch, there's a Coolosuchus figurine made by Collector, and it is super detailed. So not only does the head have some of that ornamentation that we talked about in episode 2, but that also extends to the pectoral girdle, so the clavicles or collarbones of Coolosuchus. And again, all that reflects the real-world morphology of this fossil. And there's even tiny hooked denticles on the inside of the mouth of this figurine. Now, that's something I didn't mention in the podcast, but in this case, denticles are tooth-like projections. The word denticles can also refer to the tiny serrations we see on teeth like in theropod dinosaurs. Getting back to Coolosuchus though, these denticles are on the palate or the roof of the mouth. And because they essentially act as a bunch of tiny hooks, this would have made it damn near impossible for prey to escape once Coolosuchus grabbed them with its massive wheelie bin shaped head. Again, aren't you glad you don't live in the Cretaceous? Anyway, my final footnote for the Coolosuchus episode is related to function rather than form. So do you remember when I was trying to describe Temnospondyl swimming and compared them to crocs? Can we play some flashback music?
So it makes sense that it would have a powerful tail adapted for swimming and propelling itself through water.
As it turns out, we now have fossil evidence for this behavior. So less than a week after the Coolosuchus episode dropped, a new paper came out entitled Unique Trackway on Permian Karoo Shoreline Provides Evidence of Temnospondyl Locomotory Behavior, end quote. And that was published by David Groenvold and colleagues in the journal PLOS One. PLOS One, by the way, is an open access journal, so all of their stuff is free and publicly available. I'll also link to that paper in the show notes. But basically, using 3D surface scanning techniques, which we mentioned in our bonus episode on BAMP, these authors studied trace fossils, including swim traces and body impressions. Based on this evidence, the legs were tucked up near the sides and the tail pushed the animal forward as it swam through the water, similar to how modern crocs swim today. Now, I should point out that these fossils are from the Permian and these traces are attributed to a rhinosuchid temnospondyl, whereas Coolosuchus is a member of the superfamily Brachiopoidea and is in the family Shigitosauridae. So while it's likely that Coolosuchus was swimming in a similar manner, Groenvold and colleagues were in fact looking at a different branch of the temnospondyl family tree. Still, it's pretty cool to see more research on these lovable weirdos and find some fresh research to back up what was an educated guess on my part. Last thing before we wrap up, I wanted to point you in the right direction and give you some podcast recommendations if you're chasing more botany and plant science content. If you want to learn more about gymnosperms, highly recommend episode 155 of the Common Descent podcast with special guest paleobotanist Dr. Ali Baumgartner. Love episodes with Ali, especially the 2021 Halloween series Common Descent did on speculative evolution, where they tried to come up with ways of evolving monster plants. I think I requested we listen to that specifically in the car the night Harry broke his second collarbone and I drove him to the hospital. If you want me to do more plant podcast episodes, let me know. I'm at Pals and Paleo on Instagram. Otherwise, the Planthropology podcast with Dr. Vikram Baliga will scratch your itch. And if you're not sure where to start, might I recommend my favorite episode of Planthropology, which is number 74 with Ellen Weatherford, who I also mentioned this episode. Again, Ellen and her husband, Christian Weatherford, are the hosts of the animal review podcast, Just the Zoo of Us. I think that there's actually been a bit of crossover between those two shows. But again, my favorite Planthropology podcast episode was when Vikram and Ellen talked about grass-type Pokemon and the real-world inspiration behind their designs. The banter between the two of them is delightful. It's worth listening to just for that. Thanks for listening. I hope today's episode was enlightening, informative, and just weird enough to keep your attention. Don't forget, you can get in touch with me online and don't be afraid to say hi and reach out, especially if you want to talk about fossils and paleontology. I'm always up for a yarn. A big Pals and Paleo thank you to Dr. Anne-Marie Tossolini for sharing her wisdom and insight about the wonderful world of paleobotany and explaining a little bit more about Glossopteris and how this fossil plant has been incredibly important in the global scheme of things. Thank you to Francie for editing the show and a big thank you to his band, Hello Kelly, for our freaking amazing theme music. PSA, they also made a song about Steve Harrington, aka the best character from Stranger Things. You can listen to that song on their Instagram. Their handle is at Hello Kelly Music. And check out their latest album, Sweet Nostalgia, which is available on their website, on Spotify, and anywhere you get good music. Shout out to Dr. Chris Mays for starting me on this path. His enthusiasm for all things paleontology and teaching in general is infectious. It has had a profound effect on me, and there were others in my cohort that have gone on to do postgraduate research. And yeah, it's absolutely amazing what impact a great teacher can have. Finally, thanks to my buddy Caesar for producing the show and keeping me on track. If you want to hear from him, check out his podcast, Death by Birding, but beware, there are swear words. Thanks again for listening. If this is your first time listening to the show, I hope you enjoyed it, and thanks so much for giving it a go. Pals and Paleo will be back soon with another fresh episode, but until then, just keep digging.